dishonesty, or the sin of theft and of injustice, by Jonathan Edwards. Exodus chapter 20, verse 15, thou shalt not steal. This is one of the Ten Commandments, which constitute a summary of man's duty, as revealed by God. God made many revelations to the children of Israel in the wilderness by Moses, but this made in the Ten Commandments is chief. Most of those other revelations contained in ceremonial or judicial laws, but this contains the moral law. Most of those other laws respected the Jewish nation, but here is a summary of laws binding upon all mankind. Those were to last till Christ should come and have set up the Christian church. These are of perpetual obligation and last until the end of the world. God, everywhere, by Moses and the prophets, manifests a far greater regard to the duties of these commands than to any of the rites of the ceremonial law. Now, these commands were given at Mount Sinai, before any of the precepts of the ceremonial or judicial laws. They were delivered by a great voice out of the midst of the fire, which made all the people in the camp to tremble, and afterwards were engraven on tablets of stone and laid up in the ark. The first table, containing the four first commandments, which teach of our duty towards God. And the second table, containing the six last, which teach of our duty to man. The sum of the duties of the first table is contained in that which Christ says is the first and great commandment of the law. Matthew chapter 22, verse 37, quote, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and with all thy soul and with all thy mind, close quote. The sum of what is required in the second table is what Christ calls the second command, like unto the first, verse 39, quote, the second is like unto it, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself, close quote. Of the commands of this second table of the law, the first, which is the fifth of the ten, refers to that honor which is due to our neighbor. The second respects his life. The third, his chastity. The fourth, his estate. The fifth, his good name. The sixth and last respects his possessions and enjoyments in general. It is that command which respects our neighbor's estate, and which is the fourth command of the second table, and the eighth of the entire Decalogue, on which I am now to insist. And here I shall make the command itself, as the words of it lie before us in the Decalogue, my subject. And as the words of the commandment are in the form of a prohibition, forbidding a certain kind of sin, so I shall consider particularly what it is that this command forbids. The sin that is forbidden in this command is called stealing. Yet we cannot reasonably understand it only of that act, which in the more ordinary and strict sense of the word is called stealing. But the iniquity which this command forbids may summarily be expressed as thus: an unjust usurping of our neighbor's property without his consent. Take note of this, Congress. So much is doubtless comprehended in the text. Yet this comprehends much more than is implied in the ordinary use of the word, that is, stealing, which is only a secret taking of that which is another's from his possession, without either his consent or knowledge. But the Ten Commandments are not to be limited to the strictest sense of the words, but are to be understood in such a latitude as to include all things that are of that nature or kind. And hence, Christ reproves the Pharisees' interpretation of the Sixth Commandment in Matthew chapter 5, verses 21 and 22, and also their interpretation of the Seventh Commandment, see verses 27 and 28, by which it appears that the commandments are not to be understood as forbidding only these individual sins, which are expressly mentioned in the strictest sense of the expressions, but rather all other things of the same nature or kind. And therefore, what is forbidden in this commandment is all unjust usurpation of our neighbor's property. And here it may be observed that an unjust usurpation of our neighbor's property is twofold. It may be either by withholding what is our neighbor's or by taking it from him. Section 1. The dishonesty of withholding what is our neighbor's. There are many ways in which persons may unjustly usurp their neighbor's property, by withholding what is his due. But I shall particularize only two things. Number 1. The unfaithfulness of men in not fulfilling their engagements. Ordinarily, when men promise anything to their neighbor, or enter into engagements by undertaking any business with which their neighbors instructs them or entrusts them, their engagements invest their neighbor with a right to that which is engaged, so that if they withhold it, they usurp that which belongs to their neighbor. So when men break their promises because they find them to be convenient and they cannot fulfill them without difficulty and trouble, or merely because they've altered their minds since they promised, they think they have not consulted their own interest in the promise which they have made, and that if they had considered the matter as much before they promised as they have since, well, they should not have promised. And therefore, they take the liberty to set their own promises aside. Besides, well, sometimes persons violate this command by neglecting to fulfill their engagements through a careless and negligent spirit. They violate this commandment in withholding what belongs to their neighbor when they are not faithful in any business which they have undertaken to do for their neighbor. If their neighbor have hired them to labor for him for a certain time, and they be not careful well to take care of that time, if they be hired to a day's labor and be not careful to improve the day, as they have reason to think that he who hired justly expected of them, or if they be hired to accomplish such a piece of work and be not careful to do it well, well, they don't do it as if it were for themselves, or as they would have others to do for them, when they, in like manner, betrust them with any business of theirs, or if they be entrusted with any particular affair which they undertake, but use not that care, contrivance, and diligence to manage it so as will be to the advantage of him who entrusts them, and as they would manage it, or would insist that it should be managed if the affair was their own, well, in all cases, they unjustly withhold what belongs to their neighbor. Number 2. Another way in which men unjustly withhold what is their neighbor's is in neglecting to pay their debts. Sometimes this happens because they run so far into debt that they cannot reasonably hope to be able to pay them. And this they do, either through pride an affectation of living above their circumstances, or through a grasping, covetous disposition, or some other corrupt principle. Well, sometimes they neglect to pay their debts from a carelessness of spirit about it, little concerning themselves whether they are paid or not, taking no care to go to their creditor or send to him. And if they see him from time to time, they say nothing about their debts. Sometimes they neglect to pay their debts because it would put them to some inconvenience. The reason why they do it not is not because they cannot do it, but because they cannot do it so conveniently as they desire, or so they rather choose to put their creditor to inconvenience by being without what properly belongs to him, than to put themselves to inconvenience by being without what doth not belong to them, and what they have no right to detain. In any of these cases, they unjustly usurp the property of their neighbor. Sometimes persons have that by them with which they could pay their debts if they would, but they want to lay out their money for something else, to buy clothing for their children, or to advance their estates, or for some such end. They have other designs in hand which must fail if they pay their debts. When men thus withhold what is due, they unjustly usurp what is not their own. Well, sometimes they neglect to pay their debts, and their excuse for it is that their creditor does not need it, that he has a plentiful estate, and can well bear to lie out of his own money. But if the creditor be ever so rich, well, that gives no right to the debtor to withhold from him that which belongs to him. If it be due, well, it ought to be paid, for that is the very notion of its being due. And it is no more lawful to withhold from a man what is his due without his consent, because he is rich and able to do without it, than it is lawful to steal from a man because he is rich and able to bear the loss. Section number 2. The dishonesty of unjustly taking your neighbor's property. Now, the principal ways of doing this seem to be these four: by negligence, by fraud, by violence, or by stealing, strictly so-called. Number 1. The first way of unjustly depriving our neighbor of that which is his, well, is by negligence, by carelessly neglecting that which is expected by neighbors, one of another, and is necessary to prevent our neighbor's suffering in his estate by us, or by anything that is ours. And in order that neighbors may live one by another, without suffering in their lawful interests, rights, and possessions, one by another. For instance, when proper care is not taken by men to prevent their neighbor's suffering in the produce of his fields or enclosures from their cattle or other brute creatures, which may be either through negligence with regard to their creatures themselves in keeping those that are unruly and giving them their liberty, though they know that it is not fit to have their liberty, and are commonly wanting to break into their neighbor's enclosures greatly to his damage, or through a neglect of that which is justly expected of them, to defend others' fields from suffering by the neighborhood of their own. Well, in such cases, men are guilty of unjustly taking from their neighbor what is his property. And it is said in the law of Moses, Exodus chapter 22, verse 5, quote, "If a man shall cause a field or vineyard to be eaten, and shall put in his beast, and shall feed in another man's field, of the best of his own field, and of the best of his vineyard, shall he make restitution." Close quote. Now, a man may be unjustly the cause of his neighbor's field or vineyard for being eaten, either by putting in his beast, and so doing what he should not do, or by neglecting to do what he should do to prevent his beast from getting into the field in the first place. And what is said in the 144th Psalm and two last verses, supposes that a people who carry themselves as becomes a people whose God is the Lord will take thorough care that their beasts do not break into their neighbor's enclosures. Quote, that our oxen may be strong to labor, that there be no breaking in nor going out, that there be no complaining in our streets. Happy is that people that is in such a case. Yes, happy is that people whose God is the Lord. Close quote. Number two, taking away that which is our neighbor's by fraud or by deceiving him is another mode of usurping our neighbor's property. And this is the case when men in their dealings take advantage of their neighbor's ignorance or oversight or mistake to get something from him or when they make their gains. By concealing the defects of what they sell, putting off bad for good, though this be not done by speaking falsely, but only by keeping silent. Or when they take a higher price than what they sell is really worth, and more than they could get for it if the concealed defects were known. Or when they sell that for good, which is indeed not good at all, which is condemned. In Amos chapter 8, verse 6, quote, yea, and sell the refuse of the wheat, close quote. If a man puts off something to another with defects that are concealed, knowing that the other receives it as good, and pays such a price for it, under a notion of its having no remarkable defect other than what he sees, and takes the price which the buyer under that notion offers, well, the seller knows that he takes a price of the buyer for that which the buyer had not of him. For the buyer is deceived and pays for those things which he finds lacking in what he buys. And it's just the same thing as if a man should take a payment that another offers him through a mistake for that which he never had of him, thinking that he, had it of him when he had it not. And so a man fraudulently takes away that which is his neighbor's when he gets his money from him by falsely commending what he has to sell above what he knows to be the true quality of it, and attributes those good qualities to it which he knows it does not have. Or, if he does not that, yet sets forth the good qualities in a degree beyond what he knows to be the true degree, or speaks of the defects and ill qualities of what he has to sell, if they were much less than he knows they are. Or on the contrary, when the buyer will cry down what he is about to buy, contrary to his real opinion of the value of it. All I can think of on this is used cars, and cars in general. It's a good example. And these things, however common they be in men's dealings with one another, are nothing short of iniquity and fraud and a great breach of this commandment upon which we are now discoursing. Proverbs chapter 20, verse 14, quote, it is nothing. It is nothing, says the buyer, close quote. But when he has gone his way, then he brags. Close quote. Many other ways there are whereby men deceive one another in their trading, and whereby they fraudulently and unjustly take away that which is their neighbor's. Number three, another mode of unjustly invading and taking away our neighbor's property is by violence. Now, this violence may be done in many different degrees. Men may take away their neighbor's goods either by open violence, either making use of superior strength, forcibly taking away anything that is his, or by express or implicit threatenings, forcing him to yield up what he is in, what he has into their hands, as is done in open robbery and piracy. or by making use of some advantages which they have over their neighbor in their dealings with him, constraining him to yield to their gaining unreasonably of him, as when they take advantage of their neighbor's poverty to extort unreasonably from him for those things that he is under necessity of procuring for himself or his family. This is an oppression against which God has shown a great displeasure in his word. Leviticus chapter 25, verse 14, quote, "And if you sell anything unto your neighbor, or buys outright of your neighbor, you shall not oppress one another," close quote. Also, Proverbs chapter 22, verses 22, Proverbs chapter 22, verses 22 and 23, quote, "Rob not the poor, because he is poor, neither oppress the afflicted in the gate, for the Lord will plead their cause and spoil the soul of those that spoiled them," close quote. And also Amos chapter 4, verses 1 and 2, quote, "Hear this word, ye king of Bashan, that are in the mount of Samaria, which oppress the poor, which crush the needy. The Lord hath sworn in his holiness that he will take you away with hooks, and your posterity with fish hooks," close quote. When the necessity of poor, indigent people is the very thing whence others take occasion to raise the price of provisions, even above the market value, this is such an oppression. There are many poor people whose families are in such necessity of bread that they, in their extremity, will give almost any price for it rather than go without it. Those who have to sell, though hereby they have an advantage in their hands, yet surely should not take the advantage to raise the price of provisions. I would also, to make a short note, I would take in the case of unnecessary inflation in the year 2021 by the present president of the United States with regard to fuel. We should doubtless think that we had just cause to complain if we were in such necessity as they are and were reduced to their straits and were treated in this manner. And let us remember that it is owing only to the distinguishing goodness of God to us that we are not in their circumstances. And whatever our present circumstances are, yet we know not but that the time may still come when their case may be ours. Men may oppress others, though they be not poor, if they will take advantage of any particular necessities of their neighbor, unreasonably to extort from him. The case may be so at particular seasons, particular seasons that those who are not poor may stand in particular and extraordinary need of what we have or what we can do for them, so that it would be greatly to their disadvantage or loss to be without it. Now, to take advantage of their urgent circumstances to get from them an unreasonable price is a violent dealing with our neighbor. It is very unreasonable to say that such men are so rich and get money so much more easily than I, that it is no hurt for me to take advantage when they are in special need and make them give up for work that I do for them a great deal more than I would desire to ask of other men. Let such consider whether, if they should by any means hereafter get forward in the world and come to have plentiful estates, that they would like that person should act such upon such principles towards them. That men are rich gives us no more right to take away from them what is theirs in this way than it does to steal from them because they come easily by their property and can do without it better than we. Take note of that, Congress. Again, another thing that is a kind of violent taking from our neighbor what is his is taking the advantage of the law to gain from others when their cause in honesty and conscience is just and good. The circumstances of mankind, their rights, their possessions, and their dealings one with another are so various that it is impossible that any body of human laws should be contrived to suit all possible cases and circumstances. And hence, the best laws may be abused and perverted to purposes contrary to their general design of laws, which is to maintain the rights and secure the properties of mankind. Human laws have a regard due to them, but always in subordination to the higher laws of God and of nature. And therefore, when it so happens that we have an advantage by the law to gain what the laws of moral honesty allow not, it is an oppression, and it is violence to take the advantage. That human laws allow it will not excuse us before God, the judge of the world, who will judge us another day by his own laws and not by the laws of the commonwealth. Number four. The fourth way of unjustly taking from our neighbor that which is his is stealing, so-called. All unjust ways of taking away, or invading, or usurping what is our neighbor's, like eminent domain, are called stealing in the most extensive use of the word, and all is included in the expression in this commandment. Yet the word stealing, like wealth redistribution, as it is more commonly called and used, is not of so great extent, and extends not all unjust invasion of our neighbor's property, but rather only a particular kind of unjust taking, like eminent domain. So then in the common speech, when we speak of fraudulent dealings, or of extortion, or of unfaithfulness in our trust, and of stealing, we understand different sins by these expressions, though they are an usurpation of what is our neighbor's. Stealing, strictly so-called, may be thus defined: a designed taking of our neighbor's goods from him without his consent or knowledge. It is not merely a withholding of what is our neighbor's, but rather a taking away, and therein it differs from unfaithfulness in our undertakings and betrustments, and also from negligence in the payment of debts. It is a designed or willful depriving of our neighbor of what is his, and so differs from wrongdoing our neighbor in his estate through carelessness or negligence. It is a taking of our neighbor's goods without his knowledge, kind of like Congress doing deals with other countries, stealing from the taxpayer without the taxpayer having an accounting of it. It is a private, clandestine taking away, and so differs from robbery by open violence. And so also it differs from extortion, for in that the person knows what is taken from him. The aim of him that takes is no other than that he should know it. For he makes use of other means than his ignorance to obtain that which is his neighbor's. In other words, violence to constrain him to give it up. So also it differs from fraudulent dealing or trading. For though in fraudulent dealing the lawful possessor doth not understand the ways and means by which he parts with his goods, and by which his neighbor becomes possessed of them, yet he knows the fact, the deceiver designedly conceals the manner only. Kind of like insider stock trading. Congress gets rich, the people get robbed. But in stealing, strictly so-called, he that takes intends not that it shall be known that he takes. And it also differs from extortion and fraudulent dealing, in that it is completely without the consent of the owner. For in extortion, though there be no free consent, yet the consent of the owner is in some sort gained, though by oppressive means. So, in fraudulent dealing, consent is in some sort obtained, though it be by deceit. But in stealing, no kind of consent is obtained. A person may steal from another, yet not take his goods without the knowledge of the owner, because he may know of it accidentally. Well, he may see what is done, unaware to the thief. In other words, he gets caught. Therefore, I have denied stealing, a designed taking without the consent or knowledge of the owner. If it be accidentally known, yet it is not known in the design and intention of the thief. The thief is so far at least private in it, that he gives no notice to the owner at the time. It must also be without the consent of the owner. Now, a person may take without the knowledge of the owner, and yet not take without his consent. The owner may not know of his taking at the time, or of his taking any particular thing. Yet there may be his implicit consent. Kind of like taking more than what you say you're going to take. There may have been a general consent, if not expressed, but yet implied. The circumstances of the affair may be such that his consent may well be presumed upon, either from an established custom, allowed by all, or from the nature of the case, the thing being of such a nature that it may well be presumed that none would refuse their consent, as in the case of a person's accidentally passing through his neighbor's vineyard in Israel and eating his fill of grapes. Or from the circumstances of the person, as is the case in many instances, of the freedom which near neighbors and intimate friends often take, and of that boldness which they use with respect to each other's goods. Well, in all such cases, though the owner does not particularly know what is done, yet he that takes does it not with any contrived, designed concealment. In other words, it's not premeditated. And though there is no express particular consent, yet there is a consent, either implied or justly presumed upon. And he that takes doesn't do it designedly without consent. It may happen, in some cases, that one may take the goods of another, both without his knowledge and consent, either explicit or implicit, but through mistake, yet he may not be guilty of stealing. Therefore, the design of him who takes must come into consideration. when he designedly takes away that which is his neighbor's without his consent or knowledge, then he steals. So that if it should happen that he has both his consent and knowledge and without his design, he steals. And if so, it happens that he takes without either his neighbor's consent or knowledge, and yet without his own design, he steals not. I desire, therefore, that this, which I take to be the true definition of theft or stealing, may be borne in mind. That is, a design taking of our neighbor's goods without his consent or knowledge, because it is needful to clear up many things which I have yet to say on this subject. Section 3. Dishonest excuses. Now here, I shall particularly take notice of some things by which persons may be ready to excuse themselves in privately taking their neighbor's goods, which, however, cannot be a just excuse for it, nor will they make such a taking to be stealing. Number one, that the person whose goods are privately taken owes or is in debt to him that takes them. Well, now some may be ready to say that they do not take that which is their neighbor's. They take that which is their own, because as much is due to them, and their neighbor owes them much, and unjustly detains it, and they know not whether ever they shall get their due of him. Their neighbor will not do them right, and therefore they must right themselves. Well, such pleas as these will not justify a man in going in a private and clandestine manner to take away anything of his neighbor's from his possession without his consent or knowledge. His doing this is properly stealing. For though something of his neighbor's, which is as valuable as what he takes, may be due to him, that does not give him such a right to his neighbor's goods, that he may take anything that is his neighbor's, according to his own pleasure, and at what time and in what manner he pleases. That his neighbor is in debt to him does not give him a right to take it upon himself to be his own judge, so that he may judge for himself which of his neighbor's goods shall be taken from him to discharge the debt, and that he may act merely according to his own private judgment and in pleasure in such a case, without so much as acquainting his neighbor with the affair. In order to warrant such a proceeding as this, everything that his neighbor has must be his. A man may not take indifferently what he pleases out of a number of goods without the consent or knowledge of any other person, unless everything belongs to him, to be disposed of as he pleases. In such a way, abusing goods according to our own pleasure, that is, taking what we will, and at what time we will, can be warranted by nothing but a dominion over the whole. And though he who is in debt may be guilty of great injustice in detaining what is due to another, yet it does not thence follow, but that he takes from him may also be guilty of great injustice towards him. The course he takes to right himself may be very irregular and unreasonable, and such a course that, if universally allowed and pursued in such cases, would throw human society into confusion. When men obtain a property in any of the professions of this life, they are at the same time also invested with a right to retain a possession of them till they are deprived of them in some fair and regular proceeding. Every man has a right to hold his estate and to keep possession of his properties so that no other can lawfully use them as his own until he either parts with them of his own accord or until it be taken from him according to some established rule, in a way of open justice. Therefore, he who, under pretense of having just demands upon his neighbor and privately takes his goods without his consent, takes them unjustly, and is guilty of stealing. Number two, much less will it make such a private taking not to be stealing, that he who takes has, in a way of kindness or gift, done for the person from whom he takes, as much as is equivalent to the value of what he takes. If a man does his neighbor some considerable kindness, whether in labor or in something that he gives him, what he does or gives is supposed to be done voluntarily, and he is not to make his neighbor a debtor for it. And therefore, if anything be taken privately away upon any such consideration, it is gross stealing. For instance, when any person needs to have any services done for him, where a considerable number of hands are necessary, it is common for the neighborhood to meet together and join in helping their neighbor, and frequently some provision is made for their entertainment. If any person who has assisted on such an occasion and is a partaker at such an entertainment shall think within himself that the service that he's done is worth a great deal more than what he shall eat and drink here, and therefore shall take liberty privately to take of the provision set before him to carry away with him, purposely concealing the matter from him who has entertained him, this is gross stealing. And it is a very ridiculous plea which they make to excuse so unmanly and vile an act. Persons in such cases may say to themselves that the provision is made for them and set before them, and that it is a time wherein considerable liberty is given. They think, seeing that they've done so much for their host, that they may take something more than they eat and drink there. But then, if that's the case, let them be open in it. Let them acquaint those with it who make the entertainment, and let it be not done in any way in a secret, clandestine manner, with the least design or attempt to avoid their notice. On the contrary, let care be taken to give them notice and obtain their consent. When persons do such things in a private manner, they condemn themselves by their own actions. Their doings, what they do secretly, shows that they are conscious toward themselves, that they go beyond what is expected that they should do, and do what would not be allowed if it were known. And such an action, however lightly they may make of it, is abominable theft. And what any person of religion or any sense of the dignity of their own nature would to the greatest degree abhor and detest. Number three, it is not sufficient to make a private taking without consent not to be stealing, that it is but a small matter that it is taken. If the thing be of little value, yet it be of a worth purposed in concealing from the owner, the value is great enough to render the taking of it proper theft. If it be pretended that the thing is of so small a consequence that it is not even worth asking for, well then surely it is not worth a purposed concealing from the owner when it is taken. He who, under this pretense, conceals his taking, in the very act contradicts his own pretense. For his action shows that he apprehends, or at least suspects, that as a small a matter as it is, that the owner would not like the taking of it, if he knew it. Otherwise, the taker would not desire to conceal it. The owner of the goods, and not other people, is the proper judge, whether what he owns be of such a value that it is worth his while to keep it, and to refuse his consent to the taking of it from him. He who possesses, and not he who takes away, has a right to judge of what consequence his possessions are to him. He has a right to set what value he pleases on them and to treat them according to that value. Besides, merely that a thing is of so small a value cannot give a right to others purposely and designedly to take it away without the knowledge or consent of the owner. Because if this only gives a right, then all have a right to take things of small value. And at this rate, a great number of persons, each of them taking from a man that which is of small value, might take away all he has. Therefore, it will not justify a person in purposely taking such things as fruit from the trees or gardens or fields of their neighbors without their knowledge or consent, that the things which they take are things of small value. Nor is that sufficient to render such an act not an act of theft, properly so called. And this shows also the smallness of the value of what is privately taken at feasts and entertainments. Does not render the taking of such things not stealing. The small value of a thing may in some cases justify an occasional taking of things, so far as we may from thence and from what is generally allowed, reasonably presume that the owner gives his consent. But if that be the case, and persons really take, as supposing that the owner consents to such occasional taking, then he that takes will not at all endeavor to do what he does secretly, nor in any measure to avoid notice. But merely the smallness of the value of a thing can never justify a secret taking of what belongs to someone else. Section number 4, the subject applied and the dishonest warned. The first use that I would make of this doctrine is to warn against all injustice and dishonesty as to what appertains to our neighbor's temporal goods or possessions. Let me warn everybody to avoid all ways of unjustly invading or usurping what is their neighbor's. And let me press that exhortation of the apostle, Romans chapter 12, verse 17, quote, provide things honest in the sight of all men, close quote, which implies that those things which we provide for ourselves and use as our own should be such as we come honestly by, and especially that we should avoid all clandestine or underhanded ways of obtaining anything that is our neighbor's, either by fraudulent dealing or by that taking without our neighbor's knowledge and consent, of which we have been speaking. I warn you to beware of dishonesty in withholding what is your neighbor's, either by unfaithfulness to your trust in any business which you undertake, or by withholding your neighbor's just and honest dues. Consider that saying of the apostle, Romans chapter 13, verse 8, quote, owe no man anything but to love one another, close quote. Be also warned against wronging your neighbor or injuring him in his enclosures or in any of his just rights and properties through careless neglect of what is reasonably expected by neighbors one of another, in order that they may live one by another without mutual injury. Let all people beware that they bring not guilt on their own souls in the sight of God by taking an advantage to oppress any person. Especially beware of taking advantage of others' poverty to extort from them. For God will defend their cause, and you will be no gainers by such oppression. Beware also of all injustice by deceitful and fraudulent dealing. Now you doubtless meet with an abundance of temptation to fraud, and have need to keep a strong guard upon yourselves. There are many temptations to falsehood or trading, both about what you would buy and what you have to sell. There are, in buying, temptations to do, as in Proverbs chapter 20, verse 14, quote, it is nothing, said the buyer, close quote. There are many temptations to take indirect courses, to blind those with whom you deal, about the qualities of what you have to sell, to diminish the defects of your commodities, or to conceal them, or to put off things for good, which are bad, or even an unbalanced scale. There are doubtless many other ways that men meet with temptations to deceive others, which your own experience will better suggest to you than I. But here and now I shall take occasion to speak of a particular kind of fraud, which is very aggravated, and is rather a defrauding of God than of man. What I mean is the giving of that which is bad for good in public contributions. Though it be a matter of great shame and lamentation that it be that it should be so, yet it is to be feared, from what has sometimes been observed, that there are some who, when there is a public contribution to be made for the poor, or some other pious and charitable use, sometimes take that opportunity to put off their bad money, that which they find or think their neighbors will refuse to take at their hands, because they will have opportunity to see what is offered them, and to observe the badness of it, even that they therefore take opportunity to put off God. Hereby they endeavor to save their credit, for they apprehend that they shall be concealed. They appear with others to go to the contribution that is not known, but that they put in that which is good. But they cheat the church of God and defraud the expectations of the poor, or rather they lie to God, for those who receive what is given, standing as Christ's receivers, and not as acting for themselves in this matter. I'm going to tell you right now, this is not talking about a tithe. Edwards is talking about generous contributions of free will giving, not the predetermined 10% of the gross income that is fraudulently being conducted in today's visible church. They that do thus do that which is very much of the same nature with that sin against which God denounces that dreadful curse in Malachi chapter 1, verse 14. Quote, cursed be the deceiver which hath in his flock a male, and vows and sacrifices unto the Lord a corrupt thing. For I am a great king, saith the Lord of hosts, and my name is dreadful among the heathen, close quote. That has in his flock a male, a ewe, or that has in his flock that which is good and fit to be offered to God. For it was the male of the flock principally that was appointed in the law of Moses to be offered in the sacrifice. He has in his flock that which is good, but rather he vows and sacrifices to the Lord the torn, the lame, and the sick, as it is said in the foregoing verse. He said also, quote, behold, what a weariness is it that ye have snuffed at it, saith the Lord of hosts, and brought that which was torn, and the lame, and the sick. Thus ye brought an offering. Should I accept this of your hands, saith the Lord? Close quote. Contributions in the Christian church come in the room of sacrifices in the Jewish church. Mercy comes in the room of sacrifice. And what is offered in the way of mercy is as much offered to God as the sacrifices of old were. For what is done to the poor is done to Christ, and he that has pity on the poor lends to the Lord. Proverbs chapter 19, verse 17. Again, he's not talking about tithing. He's not talking about the enrichment of pastors like Osteen and Copeland, Creplo Dollar, and the many that are like them that get rich off of the poor, that defraud the fatherless and the widow. I'm not talking about that. The Jews that offered the sick and lame of the flock knew that if they had offered it to their governor and attempted to put it off as part of the tribute or public taxes due to their earthly rulers, it would not be accepted. And therefore, they were willing to put it off to God. Quote, "And if ye offer the blind for sacrifice, is it not evil? And if ye offer the lame and the sick, is that not evil? Offer it now unto your governor. Will he be pleased with you, or accept your persons, saith the Lord of hosts?" Close quote. And so those persons who purposely put bad money into contributions know that what they put in would not be accepted if they should offer to pay their public taxes. Yea, they know that their neighbors would not accept it at their hands, and therefore they are willing to save themselves by putting it off to God. Well, this practice has also very much of the same nature of sin, of the sin of Ananias and Sapphira. What they offered was by way of contribution for charitable uses. The brethren sold what they had and brought it into a common stock and put all under the care of deacons, that the poor might every one of them be supplied. Ananias and Sapphira brought a part of their possessions and put it into the common stock. And their sin was that they put it in for more than it really was, but rather what a part of what they had. And they put it in and would have it accepted as if it had been everything they owned. So those among us of whom I am speaking that put off what they put into the charitable stock for more than it is, or they put it in under the notion that it is something of some value. They intend it to be, that it shall be so taken by the church that sees them go to the contribution, when indeed they put in nothing at all. Ananias and Sapphira were charged with lying to God and doing an act of fraud towards the Lord himself in what they did. Acts chapter 5 verse 4, quote, "Whilst it remained, was it not your own? And after it was sold, was it not in your own power? Why have you conceived this thing in your heart? You haven't lied to men, but unto God." Close quote. So that those who knowingly put bad money for good into a contribution for a charitable use, as much as in them lies, commit an act of fraud and deceit towards God. I think what Edwards is talking about here is ill-gotten gains financially. In other words, stealing from other people through any means of business and then adding it to what you would contribute in a manner of gifts in your local church. Okay? "For the deacons who receive what is contributed receives it not in their own names, but as Christ's receivers. I hope these things may be sufficient to deter every listener from ever daring to do such a thing in the future." Again, another thing I would warn you against is stealing, properly and strictly so called, or designedly taking away any of your neighbor's goods without his consent or knowledge. And especially, I would now take occasion to warn against a practice which is very common in this country, particularly among children and young people, and that is stealing fruit from their neighbor's trees or enclosures. There is a licentious liberty taken by many children and young people in making bold with their neighbor's fruit, and it is to be feared that they are too much countenanced in it by their parents and many elder people. In other words, when Edwards is saying countenanced here, they're turning a blind eye to it. Or it's looked at as no big deal. Okay? I am sensible that the great thing which is pleaded and made very much the ground of this liberty which is taken and so much tolerated is a very abusive and unreasonable construction and application of that text of Scripture in Deuteronomy chapter 23, verse 24. Quote, "When you come into your neighbor's vineyard, then you may eat grapes to your fill, but you shall not put any in your vessel." Close quote. Because this text seems to be so much mistaken and misunderstood, I shall therefore endeavor particularly to state the matter of persons taking their neighbor's fruit and to set it in a just and clear light as concerning this text. It was to eat their fill of grapes when they occasionally came into or passed through their neighbor's vineyard, and not that they should go there on purpose to eat grapes. This is manifest by the manner of the expression, quote, "When you come into your neighbor's vineyard, you may eat." In other words, i.e., when you come over here on some other occasion. If God had meant to give them leave to come over there on purpose for no other end, it would not have been expressed as such, but rather thus. You may come into your neighbor's vineyard and eat grapes to the fill. Such were the circumstances of that people, and vineyards among them were so common that there was no danger that this liberty would be attended with ill consequence. Now it is manifest throughout the history of ancient Israel that the vineyards among them were so common that the people in general had them. Every husbandman among them was a vine dresser, or a farmer, is what we would call them, farmers in 2021. And a great part of the business of a husbandman among them consisted in dressing and taking care of his vineyards. Grapes seemed to have been the most common sort of fruit that they had. Besides, there was no liberty given for persons to go on purpose to a vineyard just to eat the fruit in it, so that there was no danger of neighbors suffering one by another by any such liberty. The liberty did not tend to any such consequence as the flocking of a great number to eat grapes, whereby the fruit of the vineyard might be much diminished. Such were the circumstances of the case, that the consent of the owners of the vineyards in general might be well presumed upon, though no such express liberty had been given. And you may remember that in the definition of stealing, I observed that explicit consent is not always necessary, because the case may be so circumstanced that consent may be well presumed on. And the reason why consent might be well presumed on in the case of eating grapes, of which we are now speaking, is that there should be no sensible injury or any danger of any ill consequences by which a man would sensibly suffer in the benefit of his vineyard. By the way, I would say to people of the now and the day, those of you who go through the grocery store and mac grapes or pieces of fruit or anything that you take out of a bin and just eat and not pay for it, you may think it's of no consequence and no big deal, but it's still stealing. And hence, it is the more easy to determine what would and what would not be justified by this text among us. Suppose a particular person among us had a vineyard of the same kind with which the children of Israel had. It would not justify anyone else using the same liberty when occasionally passing through it, because it would be a rare thing, and the rarity and scarcity of the fruit would render it of much greater value. Besides, if one man were distinguished by such a possession, to allow of such a liberty would have a much greater tendency to ill consequences than as if they were common, as they were in the land of Canaan. There would be danger of many persons falsely pretending and fabricating occasions to pass through the vineyard for the sake of such rare fruit. Nor would it be a parallel case if men in general among us had each of them a few vines. That would be a very different thing from persons in general having large vineyards. Nor would this text in such a case warrant men's eating their fill of grapes when occasionally passing by. And though all in general had vineyards, as they had in the land of Canaan, this text would not justify men in going into their neighbor's vineyard on purpose to eat the fruit. No such liberty is given in the text. If there had been such liberty, it might have been of ill consequence. For the sake of saving their own grapes, men might make a practice of going and sending their children into their neighbor's vineyards to eat their fill from time to time. But the liberty given in this text to the children of Israel seems to be very parallel with the liberty taken among us to take up an apple or two and eat as we are occasionally passing through a neighbor's orchard, which, as our circumstances are, we might do, and justly presume that we have the owner's consent. This is a liberty that we take and find no ill consequences. It was very much so with the vineyards in the land of Canaan, as is with the orchards among us. Now, apples in some countries are a rare fruit, and there it would by no means be warrantable for persons to take the same liberty when occasionally passing by their neighbor's apple tree, which we warrantably take here when we go through a neighbor's orchard. Which, by the way, almost wouldn't happen at all now in the 21st century, the way we're set up to live. Okay. The consideration of these things will easily show the great abuse that is made of this text when it is brought to justify such a resorting of children and others to their neighbor's fruit trees, as is sometimes on purpose to take and eat the fruit. Indeed, this practice was not only justified by the law of Moses, but it is in itself unreasonable and contrary. Actually, let me start that again. Indeed, this practice is not only not justified by the law of Moses, but it is in itself unreasonable and contrary to the law of nature. The consequences of it are pernicious, so that a man can have no dependence on enjoying the fruit of his labor, or the benefit of his property in those things, which possibly he may very much value. He can have no assurance but that he shall be mainly deprived of what he has, and that others will not have the principal benefit of it, and so that his end in planting and cultivating that from which he expected those fruits of the earth, which God hath given for the use, comfort, and delight of mankind, will not be in the main frustrated. Section 5. An Exhortation to Honesty. Under this use, I shall confine myself to two particulars, many other things having been already spoken to. Number 1. I shall hence take occasion to exhort parents to restrain their children from stealing, and particularly from being guilty of theft in stealing the fruits of their neighbor's trees or fields. Christian parents are obliged to bring up their children in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. But how much otherwise do they act to bring them up in theft? And those parents are guilty of this who, though they do not directly teach them to steal, by example and setting them about it, yet tolerate them in it. Parents should take effectual care, not only to instruct their children better and to warn them against any such thievish practices, but also thoroughly to restrain them. Children who practice stealing make themselves vile. Stealing, by the common consent of mankind, is a very vile practice. Therefore, those parents that will not take thorough care to restrain their children from such a practice will be guilty of the same sin which God so highly resented and awfully punished. In Eli, for example, of which we read in 1 Samuel chapter 3, verse 13, quote, "For I have told him that I will judge his house forever, for the iniquity which he knows, because his sons made themselves vile, and he restrained them not." Close quote. Number two, I exhort those who are conscious in themselves that they have heretofore wronged their neighbor to make restitution. Well, this is a duty, and the obligation to which is exceedingly plain. If a person was wronged in taking away anything that was his, well, certainly he is wronged also in detaining it. And all the while that a person who has been guilty of wronging his neighbor neglects to make restitution, well, he lives in that wrong. He not only lives impenitent as to the first wrong of which he was guilty, but he continually wrongs his neighbor. A man who has gotten anything from another wrongfully goes on to wrong him every day that he neglects to restore it when he has opportunity to do so. The person injured did not only suffer wrong from the other when his goods were taken first from him, but he suffers a new injustice from him, all the while they are unjustly kept from him. Therefore, I counsel you who are conscious that you have heretofore wronged your neighbor, either by fraud or oppression or unfaithfulness or stealing, whether lately or formerly, though it may have been a great while ago, speedily go and make restitution for all the wrong your neighbor has suffered at your hands. That it was done long ago doth not quit you from obligation to restore. And this is a duty with which you must comply. You cannot be acquitted without it. As long as you neglect it, it will be unreasonable in you to expect any forgiveness from God. For what ground can you have to think that God will pardon you as long as you willfully continue in the same wrong and wrong the same man still every day by detaining from him that which is his? You, in your prayers, ask God that he would forgive all your sins, but your very prayers are a mockery if you still willfully continue in those sins. Indeed, if you go and confess your faults to your neighbor, and he will freely acquit you from making restitution, you will be acquitted from the obligation. For in so doing, your neighbor gives you what before was his. But otherwise, you cannot be acquitted. Now, I would leave this advice for all of you, for the direction in your behavior on your deathbed. Indeed, you should not by any means put it off till you come to die, and you will run the most fearful risk in so doing. But if you will not do it now while you're in health, I will leave it with you to remember that when you come to lie on your deathbeds, doubtless, then, if you have the use of your reason, you will be concerned for the salvation of your poor souls. And let this be one thing then remembered, as absolutely necessary in order to your salvation, that before you die, you must make restitution for whatever wrong you shall have done to any of your neighbors, or at least leave orders that such restitution be made. Otherwise, you will, as it were, go out of the world and go before the great judge with stolen goods in your hands. And certainly, it will not be very comfortable or safe to bring them into his infinitely holy and dreadful presence when he sits on the throne of judgment with his eyes as a flame of fire, being more pure than to look on iniquity, when he is about to sentence you to your everlasting unalterable state. everyone here present who has been guilty of wrongdoing his neighbor and has not made restitution must die. Let all such therefore remember this counsel now given them. On the day when death shall approach, if they shall be so foolish as to neglect it till that time.